You and I back together again, jam-packed show for you, Thursday, March 10th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I wondered why state lawmakers are being so quick to extend some COVID-related voting regulations for this coming November's elections. Republican State Rep. Greg Howard joined us to chat about the ongoing statewide criminal justice issues. Yankee Institute of Connecticut President Carol Platt-Leibow joined us to talk about the latest State of Connecticut employee contract proposals. And finally, I shared some of my thoughts on the end of the much-ballyhooed Major League Baseball lockout. Let me start with this, and we'll start right in with our Facebook question of the day. Again, that's facebook.com/WICC600. I'll give you the question. I'll explain I'm asking it. Do you agree with extending, this could be the big, the major topic today, because again, this illustrates more of what doesn't happen. In Hartford. Do you agree with extending, because apparently that's what it looks like is going to happen. Do you agree with extending Connecticut's pandemic-related voting law changes to cover the upcoming November elections as well? Again, do you agree with extending Connecticut's pandemic-related voting law changes to cover the upcoming November elections as well? Why do I ask that? Well, you know, we went through a couple of cycles here where we basically changed on the fly Connecticut's voting laws here because we were in the middle of a pandemic, and I guess technically it's still on. You know, I've said before, lawmakers, scientists, they're going to be very wary of saying that anything is actually over and done with because they have their reputations online or whatever. But let's just say we're still in the middle of it. We still have 2% positivity. There's still about 160 people, you know, in hospitals in the state. So, okay, for the sake of argument, let's say we're still in the pandemic. Well, apparently now some of the lawmakers in Hartford think that we'll still be in the pandemic come this November. They must have a medical crystal ball. I gotta tell you, they must have prestigious medical degrees. They must. They must, because we were told last year and the year before and the previous two election cycles, hey, you know, now listen. We were told in 2020, and then in 2021, when there were some muni elections, hey, listen, we're not trying to permanently change Connecticut's election laws. We're just going to do this because it's a pandemic. Oh, really? And if this isn't an illustration of how things work here in Hartford, where, you know, the majority says, well, we want to have constructive discussions with our Republican brethren and sisterin, and guess what? Nothing ever changes. I give you this, and this Hugh McQuaid's story that was posted earlier today, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at 10 a.m. this morning. The General Assembly's Election Policy Committee endorsed two similar bills Wednesday that would continue, right? Now, we're 8 months away from the election, that would continue the pandemic policies that have eased Connecticut's restrictions on absentee ballot voting for the past 2 years. A lot of smiles in Bridgeport there when I say absentee ballots. A lot of folks in a certain political party go, absentee ballots? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Let's loosen them up. So in what should be a very, again, you know, voting rights, voting laws, voting rules, what should be done in a very deliberate manner only when absolutely necessary is now being done. Basically, I think, is a runaround. Now, I could be wrong here, but this just reeks to me of a runaround of the state constitution here. Because remember, we have a constitution that is the set of laws that's really kind of supposed to run the state. That's kind of the instruction manual we have here, you know, all those fine nutmeggers of past yarn who put together some really smart rules about running this place. Some of the earliest rules, by the way, of representative government in this wonderful country of ours, the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. I have a copy at home on my desk. I read it every so often. All right. See, there you go. Shows you I have no social life. But seriously. The Government Administration and Election Commission took partisan votes, surprise, on both bills during a meeting that was delayed for hours by behind-the-scenes negotiations between the panel's Democratic chairs and top Republicans. Negotiations, folks, that never amount to anything. They never amount to anything because it's a one-party state. Democrat Senator Mae Flexer, Willimantic Democrat who co-chairs the panel, quote, over the course of the last, well, almost 3 hours at this point, there have been some really good conversations that have been happening, she said. I'm really grateful there seems to be bipartisan willingness to try to find a bipartisan solution, unquote. That, of course, is crap. Okay, that's the kind of crap that you can grow these really nice big beefsteak tomatoes. You know, when the fertilizer's some ripe stuff out there in the middle of July. You can grow some great tomatoes, cucumbers, zucchini and that stuff. Why am I saying that? Why am I being so acerbic, Paul? You know, you're always so negative. What's the wrong with you? Well, because, as says here, despite those talks, Wednesday's meeting settled into familiar debates as Republicans argued the bills conflicted with the unusually narrow restrictions on absentee ballot voting contained in Connecticut's Constitution. The Constitution of the state, the rule book, the instruction manual on how we're supposed to run this joint. While Democrats say they were in compliance with the state Supreme Court decision, which has allowed the practice since 2020, the Constitution contains specific conditions a voter needs to satisfy in order to qualify for an absentee ballot. Specific. Tough word, I know. But all you people playing Wordle out there, whatever you do, wasting your time, should be able to do it. Though they differ in scope and language, both bills rely on the High Court's opinion that one of those conditions, sickness, is not limited to an illness suffered by an individual voter. Ah! So again, instead of amending the Constitution the right way, we're going to rely on a Supreme Court decision that's going to just conveniently work for blue voters in a blue state. The court said the existence of the pandemic supported the state's policy allowing residents to cast absentee ballots. Okay. All right, fine. So when does that condition end? Now, when might there be a pandemic? I don't know. Maybe the pandemic might still be around in November. But what if the pandemic is not around? What if it's a 0.5% positivity or 1% positivity? See, here's my point, folks, in this opening little monologue of mine, which you can comment on or concentrate on it at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Is the majority party in this state, which usually governs via crowbar, you know, anything they don't like gets whacked down, is this going to be a never-ending pandemic? When does the pandemic end? Yes, I know it's the warmer months coming. The numbers will go down. But again, should we already say, well, the pandemic's probably still going to be around. So let's just say, I don't know, screw the Constitution of the state. Is that where we are now? Mind-numbing. So again, we have all these great bipartisan discussions. Oh, we love our people in Hartford. And you know what comes out of them? Squat. And coming up this coming Monday, the 14th, a very important public hearing. It's still going to be done by Zoom, unfortunately, but it's a public hearing concerning House Bill 5418, an act revising juvenile and criminal justice statutes and insurance statutes concerning the theft of a motor vehicle. That's just one chapter that we've been talking about here over and over again when it comes to criminal justice. That's going to be held by the Judiciary Committee. It's a public hearing, but you got to register on Zoom. We'll tell you about that momentarily. And one of the gentlemen who sits on the Judiciary Committee in Hartford, who will no doubt be hearing the testimony on Monday, and who is also police detective, is State Rep. Greg Howard. We've had him on the show before, House District 43 in the eastern part of the state. Greg, hi. It's Paul again. Good to have you on. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Always a pleasure to be here. Doing great. How are you?
Well, Greg, and thank you for taking the time. We know you guys and gals are jamming up there at the Capitol in both chambers. But, you know, Greg, I just wanted to have you on because this is a very important hearing here. And this is, I guess, Greg, by the title of it, is going to focus on, I guess, a loophole or an oddity, Greg, in Connecticut law. When I tell people about this, they don't seem to believe it, about how the charges for many of these youths and juveniles, and some of whom I know you may have dealt with as a police officer, how the charges are levied according to the value of a motor vehicle stolen. Talk about that.
So under the current Connecticut General Statutes, the actual value of a vehicle dictates the, you know, whether it's going to be a larceny one, larceny two, larceny three. And so that, yeah, that's one of many issues. Monday is going to be a long day. There are a lot of issues coming up on that public hearing surrounding juvenile justice reform, juvenile crime, criminal justice reforms, police accountability. It's going to be a long day. We had a long day in judiciary yesterday. Monday will be more of the same.
And Greg, there are just so many things here that you and I have talked about before on a couple of occasions. You know, Greg, we seem to hear from one side of the aisle in the General Assembly that, hey, you know, overall crime is down, the numbers are down, this and that. But again, Greg, we seem to hear, and you've talked about it before, every few days, tragically, maybe every other week, we hear of violent crime committed by juveniles. And a lot of police officials around the state, Greg, chiefs, we hear police chiefs, high-ranking police officials say, hey, too many of these kids, these juveniles, are out doing bad things. We're not doing enough here. And, Greg, I don't know whether you saw it because I know you're busy. We had this incident in Westport here in Fairfield County where the 64-year-old driver, a woman who was driving from one of the food services, gets her car stolen. She suffers a traumatic brain injury trying to get back in the car and stop the kids here. One, Greg, had just turned 18. The others in the car were juveniles. And, again, Greg, it's people hearing this stuff now on a constant basis wondering, you know, who's asleep at the switch here?
Well, the legislature, in large part, that's who. And you know, we could go on this, Paul, for hours and hours, but we have to go back to the basic point of our criminal justice system. It's a multifaceted goal, which includes taking the offender and rehabilitating them to the best that we can. And right then we have to confess that some people are not going to be rehabilitated, whether they don't want to or what. We can go down that rabbit hole. But the fact of the matter is there are people that are going to be career criminals. And no matter what we try to do to help them, that's what they are going to do. So nobody ever wants to admit that, but it's just true. That's first of all. The second big part, which is what we're really seeing, in my opinion, with juveniles, is the criminal justice system is meant to be a deterrent to others. So if Paul steals a car and he gets a harsh sentence, Greg thinks to himself, gee, maybe I shouldn't do that. Well, that's not what's happening in Connecticut. Rather, the opposite is happening. And we know that we have adults that are utilizing these juveniles to commit these crimes because they have no real ramifications. And, you know, the other side of the aisle likes to say, well, the Republicans just wanted to throw every juvenile in jail. That's not true. It's not true at all. In fact, what we want to do is get to the root causes. But we are not going to assume the root cause from the beginning. And we understand that our criminal justice system, and specifically our juvenile justice system, operates in large part for lower level offenses as a social service program. You know, you talk about an adult court at the GA. Mm-hmm. They do a lot more social service stuff. And we had a prosecutor yesterday who came out and said, you know, almost every single case gets adjudicated pretrial with an agreement that often has to do with pretrial diversion. And that's a program that gets that particular offender somewhere where they are going to rehabilitate. And if that doesn't work, then they move on with additional sanctions, right? This is not new. It's not rocket. We're not building rockets here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same thing with juveniles, you know, in that system, even more so, and probably rightfully so, is when those lower level offenses should be, you know, more of a social service program to get these kids on the right track. But the reality, Paul, is the right track, the track that's going to work for child A or young person A is not going to work for young person B, but there's a different track that'll work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our juvenile court is full of. We're full of social workers, juvenile probation officers, juvenile prosecutors who have a litany of staff at their disposal and pretrial diversionary programs to juveniles to get them on the right track. But it has to be there has to be a wide variety of tools in their collective toolboxes to get that done, and the other side doesn't want to hear it.
And Greg, and the guest, by the way, State Rep Greg Howard, Eastern Connecticut Republican, District 43. Greg, but then again, there are these instances where people hear, you know, whatever news source says it or the police departments now, Greg, are going out of their way to say, you know, officers and such department have had numerous run-ins with the juvenile suspect. It's those people, Greg, not the kid who breaks a window or steals a box of candy and, you know, they get a diversionary program. That's fine. It's those people, Greg, that my listeners sit here and say, why can't we do better on this? And they're frustrated.
And we do, and we can do better. And here's the other part of it. You know, look, I have two kids, you know, and I think you know, and they're, you know, they're 13 and 11 or 12 and almost 13 and 11. And, you know, when they're teenagers, are they going to sneak out of the house once in a while? Probably. You know, I mean, kids are going to be kids. But when your 16-year-old child is 2 hours away stealing cars at 3:30 in the morning multiple times, there's no accountability at home. And the idea that we're going to continue to send these kids back to that environment because that's, you know, as some would say, the best place for them to be, I disagree. I think that if we need to break a cycle, and a lot of it oftentimes you see it is a cycle, and we need to break that cycle by getting these kids into places, not jails, but places that where they can be, you know, educated and shown a better way away from that crime, and that's not acceptable. And therein lies the big issue with those major incidences. They don't understand that it's not acceptable, and we're not doing a whole lot to make them understand that that's not acceptable. And furthermore, you have a legislature in Hartford that, and if you watch any part of the public hearing yesterday, I said it yesterday, I shudder to think how many times I'll have to say this on Monday. We have completely lost track of victims, completely. We have the majority party up here has been so focused on, you know, the criminal and giving them the best opportunities. And I'm all for that. Listen, if somebody gets arrested for a crime and there's an opportunity for that person to go back into society and not, you know, commit that same crime again or other crimes, great. That's a system that works. We had a whole bunch of folks, well, not a whole bunch, but a couple of folks yesterday in judiciary, the public hearing, said that they were formerly incarcerated and they're currently in law school. Those are success stories, in my opinion. These are people who have come out of our system and they're on a better path. Good. Great for them. That's outstanding. That's what we want. But we have to confess that along the way, not everyone's going to do that. A lot of people are going to continue to reoffend, and we have to continue to address them more and more and keep them out of our communities where they're going to be victimizing people, whether it's violence, whether it's stealing cars. You know, I'm not talking about a kid who got, like you said, picked up for shoplifting one time, has to go, you know, somewhere away from his parents. You know, if the parents can deal with it. And I'll say this to you. I've been a cop for 20 years. When I was a street cop, I'm a detective now. But when I was working on patrol and I had an issue with a juvenile, I had a measurement tool, a gauge, if you will. Mm. When I brought a kid home, if the parent opened the door and said to me, "Officer, what happened?" I knew right away that parent was going to handle that. I knew. But when they looked and said to the child, "Hey, what's the matter? What happened here?" And they wanted to hear from the kid. There's a problem here, and this parent is going to enable this child. And you know, no system is perfect, no measuring tool is perfect, but that one was pretty accurate. You know, looking back, you know, to where those kids are today and those particular parents, it was a pretty accurate measure.
Wow, you knew even back then. Wow, you knew even back then. Greg,
sure.
One final question here. I know yesterday there was a little bit of, from what I can read and what people have told me, I guess it was another contentious debate or a little part of the hearing yesterday, Greg, on something you probably, over your years as a beat cop, ran into, which is motor vehicle stops. And, you know, you hear about the fact that now, and Greg, by the way, I'm speaking as a suburban white guy who's gotten pulled over twice because of a blown out headlight. And the officer said, "What's the deal?" I said, "I know what I'm getting it fixed tomorrow. I'm going to the dealer," and the officers had both times, "Don't let me pull you over again, because if I do, I'm going to write you a ticket." So I understand that, you know, you officers, beat cops now are, I guess, Greg, restricted and fighting back, saying, "Hey, we're not just pulling over people for the sake of pulling them over. We saw oftentimes this leads to finding guys and gals who are wanted with stuff or who may have bad things in the vehicle."
Yeah, so that's first of all, and I asked yesterday, and of course nobody can answer this, if if having only one headlight is not enough to pull you over, then why don't we just make that the law? I mean, if it's so important to have it a law, then police officers should be able to enforce it. That's, other than that, it's just a suggestion. I mean, if, you know, let's just call it what it is. But, you know, in that particular back and forth with one of the members of the task force, when I pointed to DDACS, which is the data-driven approach to crime and traffic safety, which has been study after study in different target areas where police have been shown, and the studies show that when police up their motor vehicle enforcement, you know, across the board from equipment to moving violations, et cetera, in certain target areas, I mean, we saw 60% decreases in certain crimes, burglaries, larcenies, stolen cars, armed robberies, homicides, gun violence, you know, 66% increase in guns that were seized. I mean, so when I asked them that, you know, what consideration, and the answer effectively, you know, through a lot of wording was none. Well, you know, we didn't consider the impact on crime. The police, think about that. The accountability, Police Accountability and Transparency Task Force making recommendations and didn't consider the impact on crime. Wow. Boy, did we lose our sense of what we're supposed to be doing here. But you know what they said?
What?
They said, and he told me, this is, and this isn't me. Anybody can go on YouTube and find this link and see it themselves. He said, you know, well, we knew right away we weren't going to touch speed. We weren't going to touch distracted driving. We weren't going to touch. Oh, yeah. Well, no kidding, because NHTSA sends you a whole bunch of federal money because we have these laws. That's why. You know, and he admitted that.
I get you.
So again, what are we focused on here? And I'll tell you what we are not focused on. We are not focused on victims. Yeah. We are not focused on the hardworking people in this state that want to come out in the morning, get into their car, and go to work. And I have colleagues on the other side of the aisle have the audacity to say, well, that's what they get for leaving their keys in the car. Oh, really?
Yeah, victim blaming. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Victim blaming. Greg, thank you. State House Rep. Greg Howard, District 43. And again, we'll talk more about this important hearing coming up after the break on Monday. Greg is a law enforcement officer, by the way, as well. Greg, thank you. We'll talk down the road, my friend. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Appreciate it. There you go. Guy in the General Assembly who's actually a law enforcement officer telling you about the idiocy, right? That here are your lawmakers, folks. When faced with numbers, with broad studies that say if you pull over people for minor violations, there's a lot of criminality you find there. But see, in Connecticut, we don't see that. The first thing we see is skin color. That's all we see. A return visit now from Carol Platt-Leibau, who heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Going to talk a little bit about what we know, at least at the time being, about the offer on the table for state employees who were due for a new multi-year contract. No surprise there. Some of the elements are interesting. Carol, hi. It's Paul here again. How are you?
Paul, I'm great and wonderful to be with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you. What's your initial thought on this, Carol? I mean, we all knew the contract was coming. You know, state workers deserve a new contract when the old one runs out. Your thoughts on, and the Institute's thoughts on what we know about the deal so far?
Well, that's the problem. Right? We know very little about the deal. And at Yankee Institute, we think that, you know, as a matter just of fundamental fairness, as taxpayers, we should have the chance to see what promises our elected officials have made in our name behind closed doors before all of us are asked to pay for them. And that's why we believe that Governor Lamont should release all 35 of these tentative government union contracts so that the public, us, the taxpayers, the people paying for these contracts, and our elected representatives in the General Assembly can see them and read them before they go into effect.
Carol, is that usually done? I mean, I talk to people all the time and say, hey, how do we exactly know what's in these contracts? Do those contracts end up on a searchable database because they are paid for by taxpayers?
Well, you know, Paul, I'm happy you asked, because Yankee Institute has made it our business to put together the first database of these contracts. So if you go to yankeeinstitute.org, there is a place where you can look at every government contract in Connecticut. And we are the first people to make these contracts publicly available. The problem is that, you know, a little bit like what we were told with Obamacare, they have to pass the contract for us to know what's in it. And that's what we're objecting to right here. we have a really unfortunate history here in Connecticut of governors negotiating bad labor deals that deliver higher taxes and lower quality services. And, you know, it's an election year, and state officials are going to be seeking endorsements from a lot of these powerful unions where they put a lot of boots on the ground to do a lot of work for candidates they like. And these are many of the same people with whom they are, quote unquote, negotiating right now. So you have the government officials who want union endorsements on one side of the table. You have the unions on the other side of the table. And the only people who don't have a place at the table are the taxpayers who are actually going to be paying for these deals. And what Yankee Institute is saying is, let's just let the people who are paying the bill have a peek at the menu before everything on it is ordered.
Carol Platt Leibow is the guest. Carol, hang on. We'll come back right after this. When we come back, I want to talk about the reports that in an election year, above and beyond the promised COVID-19 extra money, which a lot of people can agree with, there is talk about a $3,500 bonus for all these workers. Carol Platt Leibow is the guest from the Yankee Institute. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Carol Platt Leibow is the guest as she heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, of course, online at yankeeinstitute.org. We feature them on the afternoon show here and on the morning show with Melissa. Melissa in the morning every 5 to 10 right here on WICC. Carol, interesting. There's also word, we haven't seen it formally yet, but there's word that this offer negotiated or is being negotiated between the two parties contains a $3,500 bonus. Now, this is not as I thought initially, Carol. I said, oh, this must be the, you know, the COVID hazard pay, which I think a lot of people would agree with, but apparently it's not. From what I read, that's still being negotiated. And, you know, Carol, there is such a thing as optics in the world, and some people may say, well, that's kind of interesting, just a bonus in an election year, which is, again, kind of wondrous.
Yes, coincidence? You decide, Paul. But, you know, other reporting we've seen by the Connecticut Mirror indicates that, you know, the administration, the Lamont administration, has promised not just these $3,500 bonuses, but we also know that government workers are also in line for not just the $3,500, but also the longevity increases that government workers routinely get, plus cost of living adjustments. And so the fact is that there's very much more on the table for them aside from these bonuses. And when you put all of this together, this is, of course, wildly out of line with what normal people in the private sector are getting. And don't forget that all of this is on top of the generous health care and pension benefits, the no layoff guarantees, and other favorable terms that are just part of the package for a state worker. And so if anyone ever wonders why our taxes are so high and why Connecticut is routinely near the top of the list for, you know, high cost of government per capita, this is why. These terms are some of the most generous in the entire country for state government. And again, you know, we aren't hearing any of this from the governor's office. We're hearing the details about these multi-billion dollar contracts through newspaper leaks. And, Paul, this isn't the way government is supposed to do business. You know, there's supposed to be some sort of transparency. As we talked about in the last segment, if you and I as taxpayers are paying for it, surely we have a right to know about it and to see the promises our elected officials are making behind closed doors.
Carol, the union officials and those from the CBAC coalition will say, well, yes, these are good contracts. They undoubtedly will say that.
And they will. If they're good contracts, Paul, then they should have no objection to any of us looking at them.
And they will also say, well, you know, we did, there were givebacks. I think they cite three or four times in recent history where they say, look, the state was in trouble. We moved on some of the things. So what would you say to folks who said that to you?
Well, I would like for them to show us any net savings that actually accrued to the state. Because there seems to be this pattern of them saying, oh, we're giving back in 1 year, but then in the next year, what has been given back is often returned to them. And so I would like to see them demonstrate any sort of net savings over time that the state has actually realized as a result of what they call a give back. Because, you know, up front, often our friends in the government unions in CBAC are often say that they are making concessions, but then they promise a savings to be realized later for a benefit that is given up front. And we never see the savings that are promised. And so it's important when they talk about a give back to see whether that give back has actually resulted in real savings for state taxpayers over time.
Finally, Carol, I mean, will this just get, you think, a rubber stamp here by majorities in the General Assembly, or do you think there might be some pushback on this, or is that just pie-in-the-sky thinking?
Well, we should ask our elected officials to actually scrutinize this contract. As you'll recall, Paul, there was a time when there wasn't even a vote on these sorts of government contracts. Yankee Institute pushed for years to make sure these sorts of contracts could not just sit for 30 days and then be deemed approved without even an up or down vote. So now at least our legislative our legislators have to go on the record with an up or down vote on these kinds of contracts. But the fact is that these things shouldn't be negotiated in the dark. We should be able to see what promises our officials in the governor's branch, in the executive branch, are making before we're asked to pay for them. And our legislators should be taking a careful look to make sure that, you know, this isn't some sort of giveaway where those who are going to be seeking endorsements from government unions aren't giving away the store to the very people whose support they're going to ask for in a couple of months. Because, again, as we talked about, it's as though you have the union, the government union CBAC on one side of the table. You have the people, the elected officials who will want their endorsements on the other side of the table. Everybody's represented. Everybody's happy except the taxpayers who pick up the bill.
The website YankeeInstitute.org. Run it all together, all one word, YankeeInstitute.org. Check out the Yankee Institute on social media as well. And Carol Platt-Leibau has been the guest. Carol, thank you as always, and we shall talk down the road. Thank you.
Always great to be with you, Paul.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, folks, what do you think? Thoughts? All right. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. It is kind of interesting that contract terms aren't readily discussed in this state. And listen, I don't think anybody is sitting here saying, well, state workers shouldn't have a contract. That is certainly not what Carol is saying, not what I was saying or whatever. But when the taxpayers of Connecticut are the employers of the fine state employees here in Connecticut, should not all the details of these deals be on the table for scrutiny by, you know, the general public whose tax money goes to pay all this stuff? But now we go from the very important stuff to the stuff that just makes us forget about life.
We interrupt this program for breaking news now on WICC.
All right, everybody calm down. Take a breath. There's going to be baseball. Relax. Everybody can put away the crying towels. Put away the pearls. You don't have to clutch them anymore. This from one of the many people who covers this thing. This is Jeff Passan. Breaking news, Major League Baseball and the MLB Players Association, he reports, have reached a tentative agreement on a new labor deal. That's what sources are telling ESPN. It still needs to be ratified by both parties. That's expected to be a formality when it is. Baseball is back. And there you go. All right. So there's baseball. Everybody calm down. take a breath, and there's rumors now they're going to make up those missed games. Of course they're going to try and make up the missed games. Come on, what are you, throwing money out the window, Maud? Sheesh. When's the season going to start? I don't know. But, for those of you who follow me on social media, and you should, if you follow my Facebook page, you know what I put up there about 3 or 4 days ago. What did I put up there? April 15th is Jackie Robinson Day. So, I don't know. I may be wrong by a day or two, but don't be surprised when MLB, everybody's kumbaya, and they're what better day to resuscitate the national pastime than on Jackie Robinson Day, April 15th. Trust me. All right, 203-333-9422-333-WICC, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. I guess the deal has been approved now by the union, so baseball is back. You know, I was discussing it with my producer, Eric, here. While the news and traffic and weather together, pardon me, we're on. And baseball is still different than any of the other three sports, or you could say four, because if you don't count Major League Soccer in as a major sport, half of the moms in Fairfield County are going to go, "What are you doing? My son Ethan is so good at soccer." Yeah, okay, whatever. You put him there because it's cheap. It's a pair of spikes. You don't have to spend anything. I'm sorry. Relax. I'm just repping all my friends who had daughters and sons that played hockey, and they were dropping $2,000-$4,000 a year on equipment. All right, face it, a lot of you. I'm not saying all of you, but for a lot of people, soccer's cheap anyway. But I digress. You know, baseball is back, and that's good, and it's good. You know, for a base reason, that a lot of people work at these stadiums, and from the parking attendants. Well, you're paying $400 to park. Just kidding. But the parking attendants, the ticket takers or the scanners, who uses real tickets anymore? I guess some teams do. I don't know. But the people that sell you the food and the beer and everything and the ushers, so that's good. But it's good that it's over. The lockout is, because baseball, more than any other sport, and even more than the NFL or the NBA, baseball is still a constant in America, and baseball is not really in your face, I mean, with screaming and yelling at every game like the way the NFL is. I mean, the NFL, pro football, it's one day a week. There's a six-day build-up to that seventh day, whether your team is playing on Sunday, Monday, Thursday, or Saturday later in the year. So there's this grandiose build-up to the NFL. Major League Soccer is 1 or 2 days a week. The NHL is a couple of days a week. You kind of know every other day, every third day. Even the NBA with all their stars and, you know, their off-season soap operas. But baseball is admittedly not the nation's number one sport anymore. And it hasn't been for years. You know, football has overtaken that. But in some ways, baseball, it's important to have baseball. And I know people are saying, "I don't care if you cancel the whole season." No, that would have been stupid. We did it once. You know, we canceled the World Series. That didn't work out well. But baseball is a constant. It's a long 6 month, half of every year constant. And it's there almost every day and every night, with the exception of maybe 1 or 2 days a month. That's a long time union thing where the players have to have a day or two off a month, whatever. But it's important that it's back, because it acts as a bromide for the country. It acts as something that soothes the country. And we even saw it during the height of the pandemic. You see it right now with all the craziness in the world. And the wonderful thing about baseball is that it's there for 6 months a year, plus the month of spring training and the month of the postseason. So when you think about it, you know, baseball is here, what, 8 months a year? It's only not there November, December, January, February. I'm sorry, November, December, January, and part of February. So it's good. It's a constant. It allows people who've had a rotten day at work or a lousy day at school or who've been screaming and yelling with their parents or their friends or their family members, they can go in a room, and whether it's online or on the radio or on TV, they can put on The Game. And The Game to people might concern the Red Sox or the Yankees or the Mets or the Dodgers, whatever. But you can just watch that game and let the pacing let the pacing carry you away. Or if you are busy and doing stuff, you can have the game on radio where it kind of belongs, people still think, and it kind of just is there in the background. And it tells you, no matter whether you're a diehard crazy fan or just a casual fan, saying, you know what? With everything going on in the world, with this crazy war, Russia and Ukraine, with the economy going nuts, gas prices, this and that, still the tail end of the pandemic, it's okay. Because in a bunch of cities tonight or tomorrow, they're playing baseball. And that's why it's good that baseball is now going to start. It was never going away. And they were going to get to an agreement eventually. How many games they were going to miss? Who knows? Who knew? But the bottom line is, it's here. And that's a good thing. And now you can start screaming and yelling with your friends and your family about the shift and their bigger bases and who stinks and who gets paid too much. And, hey, you want to make a trade for my fantasy team? Oh, please, get away. All right, so baseball's back, and that's good. And if you want to chime in on that, that's be cool as well. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. You know, again, more than the other three or four sports, you know, more than soccer, more than the NHL, more than the NBA, more than the NFL. And I'm not saying that there aren't great family memories and good times, you know, associated with those sports. Of course there are. I mean, for me and my dad, when he took me and when I took my son to expose him to stuff. But again, one of the great things, baseball is just different. And that's why, like, I'm all over my social media now and everybody's saying, oh, hallelujah, it's back. And I kind of put on my social media, okay, stop complaining and moaning. Yeah, you're angry and you're still going to go back. Because it's the one continuous thing that's kind of passed down from generation to generation. And tell me you don't remember this. Tell me you don't remember it happening to you as a child, and or B, you seeing it from your own son or daughter. You know, the first time you yourself attended a Major League Baseball game, even if your mom, your dad, your guardian, your grandmother, grandfather, whatever, even if they took you to a minor league game, maybe you went to see, geez, I don't know, if you're in, God, if you're my age, around my, you know, around my age, your first baseball exposure on a professional level in this state, in Connecticut, may have been the West Haven Yankees. Remember them? Then they became the West Haven Whitecaps, the West Haven A's, the Waterbury Dodgers. Remember them? The Brit Sox, the Bristol Red Sox, and then the New Britain Red Sox. I mean, remember all those days? So that may have been your first. You know, it was cheap back then, $1, $1.50 to get in, 50-cent cold hot dogs, but it was great. Family entertainment. Yeah, okay, the minor league teams are a little more expensive now. But you were probably taken to one of those games as a kid, and you took, and then you as a parent took your kids. I mean, my son's first exposure to baseball when he was 2, 3, 4 years old was going to a, remember the New Haven Ravens who used to play in Yale Field? And, you know, it was kind of cool to have another double-A team in New Haven. And again, what happens a lot in Connecticut cities, the demographics change, the finances become untenable, and teams leave. But, you know, having said that, one of the things that separates baseball is the first time you take your son, grandson, daughter, granddaughter, whatever, niece, nephew, to a major league game, and you see the expression on their face when they, you know, go up and find the entrance to their seat and they're walking up the ramp, especially if it's in the upper deck, and you look at them. You look, there's that split second, right? That you look at the face of your child or your grandchild or your niece and nephew, and there is sheer wonder, or they are blown away by what they see for that first 4 or 5 seconds. You remember that? You remember yourself, and it'd be tough right now if you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, or 70s, but remember experiencing that yourself? Or do you remember what your son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter did? I remember specifically, I don't remember the specific game. I could probably figure it out if I took time, but I took my son to Yankee Stadium, I think when he was, maybe five or six. I took him, picked him up from daycare. We drove down to a, you know, Yankee game at the 7 or 7:30 game, and I, you know, and he was looking at the stadium. He was like, "Oh, this is so big!" And I remember, you know, we got to, I think I had bought the tickets online or got the cheapest tickets I could, I purposely, and I tell this to young parents, as you lead your kid, you know, up the ramp to the seats, you know, and where they're going to walk out, and you get that first view. You know, when you walk out, especially in the upper deck, I always tell people I know, you know, stay in front. Try to lead them. Be a little ahead of them so you could look down and see the expression on your kid's face. And again, it's that expression of wonderment that you can't describe it. And again, that's kind of, and yeah, that may happen at an NFL game or it may happen at a NBA or NHL game, but it's just different with baseball. It is. All right, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. You know, just to finish up here on baseball, and we'll get back to the ugly side of life after this. I'm sorry. But the problem is, and baseball does have problems, but it was good they got this out of the way. So now we have like 5 years to settle in and watch the games. But here's the problem, and what baseball does take advantage of is our yearning to go see the games on a major league level. And it's this vicious, it's a vicious circle. It's the chicken or the egg thing. Geez, I took my kid to Yankee Stadium yesterday, and it cost me $450. All right, so why'd you go? Well, the kid wants to go. Well, okay. See, this is the thing. We're fans of Major League Baseball, and don't misunderstand me saying this, but it's kind of the only way that you can really think about this. Fans, I shouldn't say fans of Major League Baseball. Fans of seeing, of going to see Major League Baseball in person. That's a lot different than being a fan of baseball. You can love baseball and go watch a youth game. In your local park, you can go watch a Little League or a Pony League or Babe Ruth or American Legion ball or a good high school or even a college game for nothing or just a couple of bucks. But it's when you choose to patronize a Major League Baseball game in some markets, not every market. You know, people are amazed when they leave the Northeast here, when they venture out from, you know, Red Sox, Yankees, or Mets territory, and they go to the Midwest, and they go to Kansas City, or they go to Texas, or they go to some of these other markets and say, wow, I had a really good seat for $30 the other day. This would have cost me $90 or $100 in New York. Well, yeah, hello. Welcome to the Northeast. But the problem is that we're hooked, a lot of us. Now, I haven't been to a game in a few years because, I honestly used to love going, but the morons that sit near you and drink $15 beers and complain about it while they order more $15 beers, and the language with kids around, I mean, it's just awful. But I digress. But the bottom line is, it's just so expensive to go, but people feel they are hooked. And what I was going to say before is, look, I don't mean to be cavalier about this, but, you know, is going to a Major League Baseball game with the family 4 or 5 times a year and knowing how much it's going to cost, is that any different from doing drugs or drinking to excess or gambling to excess because you know it's bad for you, but you keep doing it anyway, right? Now, that may be a little extreme, but baseball has people who consider themselves fans caught in this vortex, this kind of, you know, sweeping kind of vortex that you just, you never are allowed to break free of, you know, for some people. You know, it doesn't mean I've never gone to games. It doesn't mean I haven't had a great time. I mean, I was at the Yankees clincher in 96 when that quote-unquote dynasty began. Game 6, you know, in New York, Yankees and Braves. I lucked out. This is before you could buy tickets online. Working at another radio station, my boss said, hey, you want to come if I can get tickets? And I said, yeah, right. Like, we're going to get tickets. And 10 minutes later, he's on the phone with Ticketmaster saying, 4 for game 6. Do you want one? I said, well, yeah. You know? And here's the upshot of that whole thing. You know what that ticket cost me? Back in, and it wasn't, listen, it was a while ago. It wasn't in the prehistoric past. You know what I paid to see a World Series game, Game 6 in New York, Yankee Stadium, Yankees and the Braves, the clincher, Game 6 in 96? $31. Can you imagine? I paid $31. You can't park for $30 at most stadiums today. You can't. You just can't. But we, $31. I've got the stubs somewhere. I'm sure I didn't throw it out. Man, oh, man.